to give a warm welcome to Bob T. from Oceano, who is our 45-minute speaker.
Hi, everybody. My name is Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, it's good to be in here with you guys. I see a bunch of familiar faces, and I guess I'm in the right place. I don't know what I'm going to say, but I prayed, so I prayed that I hear what I say, because I probably need to hear it. So I started what it was, you know, what it was like. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My dad was a pretty violent alcoholic. My mom was a drug addict. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley in the 60s, so it was pretty wild. I think I started smoking cigarettes when I was seven. Actually, when I started school, everybody has got different levels, and I really don't have a medium setting. And I'm really bad. I have poor impulse control. I do things on a spur of a minute. One time after a meeting, I stole one of my friend's cars, and his girlfriend was in the passenger seat. She thought it was really funny. He did not think it was funny. But when I started school, and they said that this guy needs to be on Ritalin. This guy needs some drugs. And my great-grandmother was a World War I ambulance nurse. And she said, no, just give him a cup of coffee in the morning. So I started drinking coffee when I was 5 or 6. And when I got to AA, I was like, you guys smoke cigarettes and you drink coffee. This is my club. So I grew up, and I don't know for you, but for me, I didn't really fit in, and I kind of started a secret life. And I started doing things. Like, you couldn't be a 7-year-old and walk down the sidewalk smoking a cigarette. So I had a smoking spot. And then I had my best friend, and we did stuff. You know, we'd go to the smoking spot, and we'd shoplift. And it was risque, and it was exciting. And then it just became normal. When my mom started smoking weed when I was 9, and I remember the day my stepfather was in Vietnam, and my aunt came over to visit, and she had some weed with her, and my mom got loaded, and I heard him laughing. And by the time I was 9, I wanted to laugh too. So as soon as I could, I got into her stash, and I already knew how to roll cigarettes, so I started smoking weed when I was 9. And I'd already been drinking. I don't know when I had my first drink, but by the time I was in 5th grade, I was cutting school and hanging out in abandoned houses and drinking beers. And it didn't really matter if they were warm or cold, but it was, and like that, it was, at first it was risque, and then it just became kind of normal. Once vices, now habits. I'd never heard that till I got to AA. I never really fit in. I was terrible at school. I don't know how many of you guys ever got swatted at school? Yeah, that's the kind of student I was. I never did real English or real math. I don't learn that way. Everybody learns different. I don't really learn that way. I just didn't. I don't know. But everything that was artistic, I really liked doing. I liked doing metal shop and wood shop and electronics. I liked drafting. I did that kind of stuff and drama. I really liked drama. And so when I was 16, I got in a fight with my stepdad, and I moved in with my dad, and he was shuffled me off to Oregon. I ended up 16 in Oregon. And I remember thinking as I'm leaving that nobody drinks and uses the way I do in Oregon. And I think it took me about 2 days to find people that drank and used like I did in Oregon. So the same stuff. I was going to school. I was doing drama. I directed a play. I was acting, building sets. I really liked it. It was really fun to be, like the book talks about. It talks about, you know, he is the actor, and he wants to present this character for the world to see. And I did that too. It was part of my secret life was, you guys can see that, but I'm going to go to my secret place. I'm going to go to my smoking spot. I think my parents and my family was kind of wild. I the first time I did any hallucinogenics was I think I was 11, and someone had spiked the frosting on a birthday cake with mescaline. So the first time I did mescaline, I was 11, and I remember parts of it. And the first time I had a blackout, I was 14, and I remember waking up, and it was really special or spiritual. I thought it was really interesting that I don't remember the night before. So when I said that I'm an alcoholic, I know that I'm an alcoholic. The way that Dr. Silkworth describes the disease concept of alcoholism, I have a physical allergy coupled with a mental obsession that tells me I really don't have a problem, that this is normal. So I ended up in Oregon, and I got a girlfriend, and I like to have sex, and I like to get high all the time, and I hated going to school, and I was drinking a lot, and I was using, and I was sick of people telling me what to do. And I was a junior in high school. I was 17. I just couldn't take it anymore. And so I dropped out of high school, and I joined the Army at 17 because I was sick of people telling me what to do. I thought it was a great idea until I got there. And then I realized I made a terrible mistake, that they weren't going to let me get out of this. And so I remember basic training, and it was the first time I'd gotten 30 days clean and sober was the first 4 weeks of basic training. And then they let us go on base. We had an on-base pass, and I went to the EM club, and I remember going there. I remember playing two games of pool, and then it was the next day. And I was in, it should have been my bed and my bunk and my room in the barracks, but it was the wrong building on the wrong side. It was the right room, it just was the wrong building. The people there, it was like a Saturday morning. Everybody thought it was really funny, but it scared me that I was running around doing things, and I was out of my mind. I got married when I was 18 on a four-day pass. My family came down to visit for the wedding, and we smoked some, I don't know what we smoked. I remember the preacher looked like he was about this tall, and I mumbled through, and then I was off to Germany. So for my 18th birthday was in Aberdeen, Maryland. I had a handful of Black Beauties. Some of you guys remember those. And a bottle of Boone's Farm. Some of you remember that too. And that's how it started. And then it was the next day. Like, I have a lot of stories of that's how it started. I ended up in Germany for 3 years. I got to go to Oktoberfest in Munich. It was amazing. I remember the ride there. I saw the Glockenspiel and the, you know, like, all of the hops and everything, the way they grow it. It was just really beautiful and wonderful. And we got there, and Munich Oktoberfest is huge, with circus tents and balloons. And I remember till about lunch. And then it was the next day. And I shot two rolls of film. So I know that I'm an alcoholic. Today I know that. I didn't know that then. I did everything that I could. I always did. I don't think that I would survive today, because I would say, somebody would go, here, eat this. And I'd say, wait, don't tell me. And I would eat it, and I'd go, oh, okay. And I'd try to guess what it was that he gave me. That's how I did that. When I was in Germany, I like to drink and drive. I mean, I'm a better driver when I'm drinking. One time I had a head-on collision with a semi in a Carmen Ghia. And it was kind of cool. It was in slow motion. But that's kind of how I, like I said, I don't have a medium setting, and I did really thoughtless, crazy, stupid things, and I'm really, by the grace of God, I'm still alive. I dropped so much acid that I could change channels without a remote. And I put myself in dangerous situations. I put my family in dangerous situations. I spent 3 years in Germany, and then I ended up in Georgia. And if they were going to give the world an enema, Georgia is where they would put the tube. But I had to spend a year there, and while I was there, I flipped a car doing 80. And my sponsor doesn't like me to tell this story, but I heard God's voice, and he gave me instructions, and he gave me a nickname. So I was sliding sideways at 80 miles an hour, and I was the passenger, and I had my arm and my head out the window. And when the car ran out of road and hit the dirt, it pitched up in the air. And I remember looking straight out and seeing the sky, and a really loud voice said, pull your head in, stupid. And when I woke up, I couldn't move my head. I couldn't move my arms. I could only see out of one eye, and the windshield was just shattered. And I'd broken my jaw, two ribs, and dislocated my shoulder. But I survived. And I you know, I got out of the Army, another geographic. Each time I would do a duty station, I would swear off, like we talk about in chapter 3, with and without a solemn oath. I would always swear off, and it never lasted. And so my daughter was born, my middle daughter was born 2 days before I got out of the Army. And I was stationed in Georgia, and I had to drive across the country. And it was, this time I have to show up, because since I was 16, like we read in to control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. I never heard that till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I knew that to my innermost self, that I could not drink and use the way that I wanted to and be a success. It was kind of, blacking out is kind of scary. Like, I didn't drink a lot of hard liquor. Like, I would black out on beer and schnapps. But I really was, like, trying to balance to not disappear for 10 hours. And do that look on my wife's face in the morning when she would tell me some horrible thing that I did the night before, or the kids were afraid of me. I ended up, I got out of the Army and I swore off. It was it. That's it. I can't anymore. I got to really, it's time to show up. And I had to drive from Georgia to California, and I made it to Oklahoma. And then I went to my mom's in California, and I got a whole bag of she lived in Humboldt County, so I got a whole bag of weed, and I ended up in one more time. It just, more of the same stuff. I just couldn't stop. I could not stop drinking and using, with and without, all of it. When I got, eventually I got a job in a plywood mill, pulling green chain, and it was drug induced. I would we would snort Black Beauties on a snuff can, and we would pull green chain like crazy people. And I worked my way into the maintenance department. I started as an apprentice, and so part of that is I had to take industrial technology to the local community college. So one semester I showed up 2 weeks late, and my instructor said, "What are you doing here, Bob?" Because he really liked me too. "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm here for my class." He's like, "Yeah, but we started 2 weeks ago. There's no way you can pass this class." I said, "There's no way that I could pass this class." He goes, "No, you'd have to come up with a project that includes the last two chapters that we did and the one we're going to have this Friday." And so he says, I go, "Really? So if I did that, I could pass this class?" He says, "If you can do that, I'll give you a D." I got a C. So, I mean, you know, Bill talks about it a lot, about willpower as far as it would go, but it didn't go far enough when it, in regards to my alcoholism. I can make things happen. I don't have a medium setting. I function really high and I do things. I'm kind of illiterate because I dropped out of high school. And so I was, my life got so entrenched of either being high and drunk or thinking about being high and drunk all the time. And it started not working and making it getting the same charge. So I started cheating on my wife. I don't know about you, but the first time it was really risque and it was really hard. And the second time just seemed like something to do. But what it did was it really messed up my drinking. Because what happened was I couldn't get to that soft spot where everything was okay and that I was a good dad and a good husband. And I'd reach for it, and I would, by the time I got there, I'd drank and used so much that I pushed right through it. And I was drinking a lot every day. I got off at work at 3 o'clock and I couldn't make it home before 10. And I would just stop off for one beer. And that's how, my drink of choice was Red Bull, Schlitz malt liquor and tomato juice. We're talking about the 80s. This is in the 80s. This is in 1985. So what happened was I was cheating on my wife with her best friend. And she liked to do speed, and I had a thing with speed. And the third day, I would have like an epileptic seizure. And the first time, it really scared me. And the second time, I was concerned. And the third time, I held on, and you know, it would stop. But I never injected it. And so, what happened was, she was doing that, and I knew that I was going to do it, and I knew it was going to kill me. And I was sitting in my living room, and I should have been really drunk, but I wasn't. And I had what they talks about in the book. I had a moment of clarity, and I saw my life as it actually was, not the fantasy. Like I told you, I had a secret life before. I had a great secret life. I was a superhero in my story. But in that moment, I saw my life as it actually was, and I was a loud and abusive father. I wasn't there for my kids. My career wasn't getting better. I was an unfaithful husband. I was distant from my parents and my sisters and brothers. And I had accumulated things that I kept pushing down, and I just didn't know what to do. Now, I'd been a latchkey kid since I was in third grade when I first started walking to school, and I would get up and I'd take myself to school and I would come home. And so I watched a lot of television. So I was sitting there. Television pretty much raised me. All the shows. I can recite the jingles for Gilligan's Island and all those shows. So I was sitting in the living room and I just didn't know what to do. I knew that I was going to do that and that it was going to kill me. It's kind of like when you see where you're going to go and you know you can't stop. And I saw a commercial on TV for a treatment program and had these two glasses and they were smashing into each other. And it says, if you or someone you know has a problem with drugs and alcohol, call this number. And so I said to my wife, I am not an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict. So I called Collect. And the woman didn't say anything about AA. But she said if I did this 28-day program that I would get a new life. And that's really what I wanted. I really just wanted a chance to start over. I wanted a chance to clear away the wreckage of the past. I didn't know that that's what I wanted. I just wanted something different. She didn't say anything about AA, because if she had, I wouldn't have went. When I got out of the Army, my dad had gotten his 7th DUI, and he goes, hey, Bobby, come on, let's go to these meetings. So I'm like, in my heart of hearts, like, I was really looking for a way out, even when I was 21. And so my dad took me to this meeting. We smoked a couple of joints, and we went to this meeting. It was in Oregon. It was really small. Me, my dad, and one other guy. And we drank a pot of coffee, and we read some stuff out of a book. And I remember leaving thinking, that's not what I'm looking for. I never met anyone that recovered from alcohol and drug addiction my whole life. Never. The men in my family, they always died within a year of their first grandchild being born. Always natural causes like cirrhosis of liver, gunshot, suicide, car wrecks. So she said that if I did this 28 days, that my insurance would cover that I could go and do it. And that to show up tomorrow morning, which was New Year's Eve, 1985. And she said, now, when you hang up with me, call your boss and tell him you're going to a treatment program, that you have a problem with drugs and alcohol, and you're going to a treatment program. So I did that because I'm following direction. You know, I'm really good at following directions. I always cleared my plate. So I called, and he said the worst thing he possibly could. He said to me, Bob, complete that program and come back. Your job is safe. We want you to get better. Man, now I gotta go to this thing. So 7 a.m., New Year's Eve, I showed up at this hospital treatment center in Roseburg, Oregon. And it was, I was in the admissions. I was still a little boozy, but I was in the admissions office and I saw my paperwork and it said, diagnosis chronic alcoholism. And I said to the clerk, I said, I am not an alcoholic. I am a drug addict. And so she looked at my paperwork and she says, well, your insurance doesn't cover drug addiction, but it covers alcoholism. And I was like, God, I got to do this thing. How much is this going to cost? And she said, $6,000. And I said, you know what? I am an alcoholic. So I got in there, and it took a couple of days before they would let me go to a meeting. They made me go to an AA meeting. And I thought, well, this is bullshit. I got to go to an AA meeting. But it was way different. It was kind of like tonight. So when you guys arrived, there was people here, and they were laughing, and they were shaking hands, and they were hugging. We used to smoke. Oh, my God, we used to smoke. Woo! Everybody smoked in AA. It was amazing. Like the cloud would be, like, right here if this was a regular home. It'd be like, and the no smoking table would be over by the door. So I had to go to this meeting in Roseburg, and it was like that. It was bright. People were laughing and joking, and then they came inside, and they got quiet, and they did a prayer thing. I thought that was weird. And then they read some stuff out of a book, and then they started sharing some really inappropriate stories, and then they were laughing about them. I thought, this is the weirdest church I've ever been to. And so I was listening to this guy, and this guy got up to share, and his name was Red, and he had long white hair. He said that he owned a roofing company. He had to go on the roof in the morning, because if he went on the roof after lunch, he always fell off. And I related to it. So I was working in a plywood mill. I was an oiler. And my job was to climb and maintain machinery while I was making plywood. And I actually got the job because my friend got hung. And so I got a call at 9 p.m. and the next day I was doing his job. So there's a few times I leaped for my life. Most of the guys are missing fingers. And when I worked there, a few people died from different things. But what really struck me, and this is what struck me, is that he didn't look like a guy that couldn't go on a roof after lunch. See, something had happened to him, and the book talks about it. It talks about after having a psychic change, these people will recoil from alcohol. These people's lives will change drastically. And I've been an apprentice. Like when I was in the Army, I learned how to be a mechanic by other guys showing me how to do it. When I was in the plywood mill, I was an apprentice. I apprenticed under a blacksmith. He used to harass me and make fun of me all the time, but he showed me all the secret stuff. And I realized that if that guy can change his life, well, I can too. Because the way that he was talking about the way it was, he didn't resemble that. See, something had happened to him. And I really wanted it to happen for me. So I went back to my treatment center. It was back when there was a hospital. I had my own room. I learned to meditate. And I just started going along. And then one day I woke up. And I didn't want to get high. And I wasn't high. And I realized that I had never felt that way before. Because up until that moment, I was either high or I was wanting to get high. And when I say that, I mean drink. Drink, use. I could never separate it. But I never felt that way before, that something had happened. Now, I was going to meetings. All kinds of meetings. And one of the things, I was in an NA meeting, and they said that you need to become a different person. You need a new playground, playmates, new playthings. You need a new game. That I could be anybody that I wanted to be if I was willing to pay the price. There's no free rides in recovery. You have to do the work. If you're coasting, that means you're going downhill. And I listened to what these guys were saying, because, like I said, I started seeing the difference. The shine in their eye. You guys got it. You guys have seen it countless times. And so I decided I wanted to be a guy that brushed his teeth, because I never brushed my teeth every day. My mom harassed me about it. People that I hung out with didn't really matter. But I was reading the book, and I didn't really understand it. And I got confused between where Dr. Silkworth talks about making a decision and where it talks about our continued sobriety is contingent on a daily reprieve based on our spiritual maintenance. I didn't really know what all those words meant. But I thought it meant that I needed to make a decision to not drink or use today, no matter what. So I don't know about you. Like when Bill's talking about when he's in the kitchen with Ebby and he says, right then my ideas about miracles had to be revised. Forget the dusty past. There across the table from me sat a miracle. There was no more power in him than there was in me at that moment. The way that I felt to me was a miracle. Like I knew something had happened. I don't know what God is. Like, you know, like Frank Zappa says, where it is written, and whatever it is, they write it on up there. Whatever God is came into my life in that moment and removed the obsession of drink and use. And I made a pact with it, is that if I could get up in the morning and brush my teeth, that I was making a physical decision to stay sober for one day, just one day. Not tomorrow, not next week. Just today. And so that's what I started doing. I started doing that every morning. And I did everything they told me to do in the treatment program. I did a lifeline. I wrote my story. I read the book. They said, I didn't understand it, but I did it. And when I got out of treatment, I went to my home. I lived in Canyonville. And so when I got home, I don't know about you guys. Y'all look really upstanding, but I've been fronted dope. And so I had to go to my connection's house, and I had to give him his money because I didn't want him looking for me. And he goes, oh, thanks. Do you want some? And my first thought was, yeah. I mean, I hadn't smoked or drank for a month. But that little voice said, you know, Bob, You brushed your teeth this morning. You made a decision not to drink or use today, no matter what. So even if it's free, that counts. And I said, no. And I never want to see you again. And I got up and I walked out. That night I went to my first AA meeting in Canyonville. Canyonville, Oregon is really small. Our AA meeting was, we only had one meeting a week, and it was in the cafeteria of an elementary school. So we had those little bitty tables that you couldn't get your legs under. And there was only about three or four people in this meeting, but I got there and I knew that I needed a sponsor. I heard about that. You need a sponsor, a guide, someone who knows the ropes. So if you're in here and you don't have one, find someone who knows the ropes and check it out. They're a good guide. It's a great tool to get you where you want to go. Happy, joyous, and free. That's where I want to be. And so what happened was, the guy with the most sobriety in the room was a forest ranger named Jim, and he had 7 years. And I said, hey, will you be my sponsor? He said, yeah, I will. He says, I don't want what you have. I had it, and it sucked. He says, if you want what I have, then you're going to have to go where I go, and you're going to have to find out what that is. He said, I'm not going to buy you a cup of coffee. I'm not giving you a ride to a meeting. I'm not buying you dinner. I don't even want your phone number. But here's mine. I'll be at Chichu Willie's every night at 6 o'clock having dinner. Come on by, and we'll talk about recovery. So that's what I started doing. It was years later that I found out that he was a forest ranger that lived 60 miles out of town. And so every night he would get off work at 4:30 and he would drive 60 miles to have dinner at Chichu Willie's to talk about recovery. And so he would be there and I would be there and then someone else would come. And we were really a small, tight community. Like here, we're a real small, tight community. Like, so there was only like three or four people that kept that meeting. If everybody showed up, there was seven of us. And sometimes we just read the book. And like, it's like that here too. Like last week I walked by that room over there and there was about a dozen people sitting around a table. And that dozen people, there's a lot of people in here, but that dozen people makes this happen. Like when they talk about the service commitments, those people make this happen. Every group that you go to, there's people that are there making coffee, they're on the boards, they're secretary and committees. Doing that. It's really important. Because if they didn't get here before us, you know, I like the expression, we stand on the shoulders of giants. Oh, man. I never know what I'm going to talk about. This really gets me. I think it's amazing. You and I are so fortunate to be alive in a world where Alcoholics Anonymous exists. 100 years ago, it didn't exist. In 1954, my grandfather was picked up for drunk and disorderly in North Hollywood, in Sun Valley, and they shipped him off to Camarillo, and they gave him 12 shock treatments. I'd like to say that he got his shit together and got sober, but he stayed the same rotten son of a bitch that he was, and then 6 years later, he celebrated my birth and died in a drunk driving. So I really wanted this to happen. I started doing what they said. I was in my group. I would go early. I would make coffee. I would set up. I had little literature rack, you know. We had to go, nice rack. But we didn't do that. But we didn't applaud or that shit. But I would set it up every week, and I would take it down and put a rubber band on it and put it in there because that's how my sponsor showed me to do it. And we'd have drunk drivers come in. My sponsor would go. We get a drunk one walking in, my sponsor going, yeah, we should pay him to come in and tell us, remind us what it was like. So I thought we would get tapes from roundups and stuff, and we'd hear about the bigger picture of AA. But I knew that it was something bigger than that. But that one weight meeting a week, that small community carried the message to me. And it helped me to sponsor guys and to work with my sponsor. And I went through the steps. When I had like 6 months, and a friend of mine was a reserve police officer in a small town, and he asked me if I wanted to go, and it was a Tuesday night meeting. So I started going to this Tuesday night meeting at the police station and learn how to be a policeman. So I got trained for 6 months to be a policeman, and I told my sponsor about it. I go, hey, listen, I'm doing this thing on Tuesday night. What do you think? He goes, well, I think becoming a police officer in your hometown is kind of a major decision. Don't swear in till you have at least a year. So I did this training for like 6 months, and when I had a year, my sponsor goes, I go, I'm going to do it. He goes, okay. So I went, I got sworn in. I go, I got to tell you something. I'm an alcoholic. He goes, we know. You go to the meeting every Friday night. It's a really small town. And I was a reserve police officer for about 6 months. I'm a registered peace officer in the state of Oregon. And I did that for a while, but I didn't really like it. I didn't like how it made me feel. And so I knew that that wasn't like, for me, that wasn't what I wanted to do. When I was about a year and a half, I'd been working in the plywood mill, and my cousin called me and said, hey, the studios are on strike. He worked in the studios. The studios are on strike. And he goes, would you like to come down and build apartments? And so I said, yeah. He was going to buy a crane. So I was like, yeah, I was ready for adventure. So I loaded, I put everything, my kids, I had three kids by now. I put my wife and my three kids over at my mother-in-law's house. We got rid of everything, put everything in storage, and I loaded up all my tools in my van, and I headed for California. And I got to tell you, I was on the road for about 5 minutes, and that little voice said, you know, Bob, nobody knows you're an alcoholic in L.A. You know, Bob, you could probably smoke weed. And I was like, eh. And I saw this hitchhiker. He looked kind of scruffy. So I pulled over, and I let him in. And, you know, I had my pistol with me. And I said, and he goes, I was thinking, you know, if this guy starts talking about cutting people up, he's off on the next off-ramp. But anyway, he gets in, and he just left a 90-day treatment program in Seattle, Washington. He was on his way to Florida. So I had a 14-hour AA meeting all the way into L.A. When I got to L.A., I joined the Burbank group, which is the sobriety capital of the world. Just ask them. And I started going to meetings. And so a few months later, I called my wife on my 11th wedding anniversary, and I sang my wedding anniversary song to her. And she's, oh, thank you. By the way, did you get the papers? Yeah. And I said, what papers? She said, I divorced you 2 weeks ago. And it was at that moment I got feeling that Alcoholics Anonymous had cheated me. That I thought that getting sober and being the stand-up boy and doing all that was going to qualify me for cash and prizes. I thought, I'm not going to have any more bad days. Because I hadn't really had very many bad days since I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I thought, I've been cheated. And I was going to kill myself. I had my pistol. I was going to kill myself. I was like, you know what? That's it. I don't need to be here. And I went to a meeting, and a guy, Tom C., got up at the podium, and he said, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous because my wife gave me an ultimatum. She said, you get sober, or I'm going to divorce you. And he says, I got sober. He said, I found out that I really came to Alcoholics Anonymous to find a life that was acceptable to me. He said, my life got so bad, I noticed, and I didn't know how to get out of it. He said, I'm the best weekend dad that I can be. I pay my child support. I'm civil to my ex-wife. I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And after the meeting, I went, and anybody in here, you can go talk to them. You can join any clique you want. There's no rules. And I went and I talked to him, and I realized that's really what I came here. I came here to find a way of life that was acceptable to me. A whole bunch of horrible stuff happened after that. My ex-wife had me take the kids, and she kidnapped them, and then she abandoned them after molesting them. And I went and got them from Oregon and brought them to California and turned them over to the state and had them placed in my home in lieu of a foster home. In recovery, I have been on welfare. I've been on food stamps. I've changed careers multiple times. In 1987, I was working in a muffin bakery, and I got a call. My cousin says, hey, do you want to get in the studios? I said, yeah. So he goes, show up tomorrow at Fox, 6 a.m. Bring your carpenter bags. So I took my carpenter bags, and I showed up. It was the first day at Doogie Howser. And so I got in the studios on Doogie Howser, and I got my days, and I started going, and I had housekeepers take care of the kids during the day because I needed someone there. And you know, that was going along. And then in 1991, I was a single parent with three kids in a two-bedroom duplex. And in 1991, I met a newcomer who is the second best thing that ever happened to me. And, I mean, I'm very respectful. I mean, I really want to stay in the sun. You know, you guys, the book's got some really great sayings, like the sunlight of the spirit. Like, I want to stay in the sunlight of the spirit. The whole God thing, I don't have it figured out. Still today, I think I'm an agnostic. I believe there's something, I don't know what it is. I have had countless spiritual experiences, but never did I get a baseball card or a business card or a flyer telling me who it was or what it looks like. I don't really know. One of the things I really like what would your experience be with God if there wasn't a Bible? If somebody didn't telling you what God is, what would your experience be? And I have a lot of things that have happened that I can't account for, that something's going on, and I don't know what it is. Maybe it's all the hallucinogenics that I took. I don't really know, but I know there's a higher power, and I know it's working in my life. Every morning I get up and I go outside and I pray and I drink water. Because for me, water represents life. I'm mostly water anyway. So I met this girl in AA, and we got married in 1994. We've been married now for 30 years. And we have walked through really hard times. I mean, when we talk about, you know, cash and prizes, I haven't had bad days. I've had really hard moments. And I worked my way in the studios to become a special effects guy. I'm a licensed pyrotechnician. I've been a high explosive manufacturer. I worked 32 years in the television movie industry. I lit people on fire and then shot guns at them. I'm flipping cars and that. I love my job, the only job I ever wanted. But I found myself 4 years ago, I have back injuries from doing things. Like I said, I really have poor impulse control. And if something needs to happen, I make it happen. Like, I don't have a medium setting, even today. And I pay the price for that. Like, I blew my knee out on a submarine in Alabama. So, I love my life. I have the best friends. If you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, these people are amazing. The very best friends I could find anywhere. A guy came out, he didn't stand up from out of town, but Bob C, that guy is my bestie. We're brothers. I'm only a week older than him. He says he hangs out with me to see what next week's going to be like. I have had so much fun since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife and I have traveled. We have been to meetings around the world. I've been to meetings in Mexico. We've been to meetings in England. One time I was the main speaker at a Neurotics Anonymous meeting. I mean, it was in Spanish. I didn't really know. And they asked me to speak. And I'm like, yeah, I will, whatever. And then I found out later that I qualify. So, we've been to meetings in Costa Rica and Hawaii. And Alcoholics Anonymous has always been there. When I blew my knee out in Alabama, I didn't know what to do. I didn't have a car. I didn't have any people. I didn't know what to do. And you know what I did? Called AA. And a guy from AA came and took me to my doctors, and then he waited for me, and then he took me to like an Alcathon, and they fed me. And I'm telling you, Alcoholics Anonymous is the greatest thing that has happened to me, and getting sober. So maybe you don't know this, but wherever you go, there is an underground of people in recovery. Like, wherever you go, like if you go on vacation, you have a timeshare thing, you can find out when they go, well, if you don't want to buy this, what the hell do you want? You go, I wanted to find out where the meetings are. And they go, oh, we'll talk to Janice. And then Janice will tell you where the meetings are. And you'll find out that the guy that owns the booze cruise is in AA, and that they know where the best restaurants are. And wherever you go when you travel, it's wonderful. So in the movie and television industry, there's a whole underground of actors. You see them sometimes. They'll get spilled on. You know, social media, that who's sober and who isn't. But there's a whole underground of us. And special effects guys are the weirdest guys you've ever met. Like, they're the guys that, well, they lit Michael Jackson on fire. But besides that, but there's a lot of them that are sober. And so we would do a fireworks show every year. So one year I was doing this fireworks show, and it was a hand light show. And that's when you, what you do is you got a guy with you, and he's your safety. And his job is to watch you, because three people die doing this every year. His only job is just to watch you. And what you do is you got all these cannons lined up, big ones, not these little farts they did the other night, but real ones. And you got them lined up with a big fuse on them, and you got a road flare. And the music's going, it's da-da-da, boom, da-da-da, boom. And inside the real fireworks is all these wires and cardboard and paper. And so I was doing this, and I had my safety with me, and he was watching me. And I'm boom, boom. And some of the stuff came down and stuck to my back and was burning me. And I could feel it. And I said, dude, I'm on fire. And he goes, yeah, man, you're doing great. I said, no, I'm on fire, put me out. And he did. And I thought, if you're ever on fire, I hope there's a member of AA there to put you out. But that's not the story, because at the end of stuff, you only get a story. The real story was, I was on fire, and I knew it. And I had a member whose only job it was to watch me. He couldn't see that I was on fire. I told him I was on fire. He didn't believe me. He didn't understand what I was telling him. I had to convince him that I was on fire before he could help me. I go to a lot of meetings. I can see when people are new. I can smell newcomers. I can see when that guy comes in and sits down and has got the don't fucking talk to me look on his face. But I can't read your mind, and I don't know if you're on fire. So if you're on fire in Alcoholics Anonymous, tell somebody. If they don't understand, tell somebody else. Every time I share my burden with another member, it becomes lighter. And every time I tell you, it gets lighter and lighter, and the solutions come. This is a wonderful program. And all you got to do is show up. We'll give you the damn book. We're not in the book selling business. We're in the life-saving business. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if it can work for me, it can work for anybody. It doesn't matter if you're from Yale or jail. AA has a wrench to fit all the nuts. I found one for me. There's one here that fits you. Thank you for letting me share.
Give him another round of applause.